Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. If you've ever listened to any episode of this podcast, you'll probably be aware of the growing understanding of the importance of the gut microbiome, with studies linking it to the immune system, brain health, and metabolism. Now, new research from the universities of Nottingham, Trent, and Warwick has uncovered yet another potential link between the gut microbiome and metabolism. The research explores endotoxins. Now, these are toxins that exist within bacterial cells, and their potential role in increasing the risk of metabolic disorders such as obesity and type 2 diabetes. With the World Obesity Federation predicting that more than half of the world's population will be overweight or obese within 15 years, research like this could be of huge importance. So, what are endotoxins and what is the link between obesity and the gut? Well, with me to discuss this is the fantastic Thomas Barber. Thomas is Associate Professor and Honorary Consultant Endocrinologist at the University of Warwick and University Hospitals, Coventry and Warwickshire. That's a lot of words, Thomas. Thank you very much for joining us.
Indeed. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
So first of all, let's just get the main stuff out of the way. What are the main links between metabolism and the gut microbiome, as we understand it and as we're beginning to discover?
Well, we could talk all week about this, and it's obviously a huge topic, and one of its challenges is to kind of try and condense it. But essentially, I think where I'd start really is to just kind of dispel a few myths, really, because we've had what's called the germ theory of disease now since the late 19th century, originally postulated by Robert Koch. And of course, this has been revolutionary in medicine. When you look at the lives saved from antibiotics and our insights into infectious diseases as well, it's obviously hard to overstate that. But one of the unfortunate consequences of that is that I think, you know, bacteria and microbes have developed a bit of a negative press. And we're all kind of influenced by this. So we all kind of naturally assume that bacteria are bad, any form of bacteria are bad, and they're bad for us. And, you know, they cause disease, they cause death, and they should be avoided at all costs. And we should all live in sterilized environments from the time we were born, because that's good for us. And actually, what's our insights over the last couple of decades have really completely dispelled that myth. And we now understand that actually microbes are absolutely essential for life, and they have what's called a symbiotic relationship with us. And what that means is that our health and physiology and well-being is utterly dependent upon the microbes, our so-called microbiota. And of course, the microbiota are dependent upon us. So this two-way relationship. And we need to remember that this kind of relationship has developed and coexisted for tens, hundreds of millions of years. I mean, goes back, you know, into the evolutionary depths of time. So this is not something that's just developed. It's literally happened over eons. And essentially, I think the way I'd summarize this is really, you know, the microbiota is a bit like a training ground for the immune system. In fact, you could imagine the immune system as, you know, the microbiota as being part of the immune system. It's one and the same thing. You know, the immune system can't really develop and function without a microbiota. And just like the British Army needs to be trained, it needs to have an order of command, it needs to be disciplined, you know, it's exactly the same with the immune system. The immune system needs to learn, you know, what's good, what's bad, what you need to tolerate, you know, what is a microbe. And we think that the microbiota helps it to do that. The problem is if the microbiota are dysfunctional or impoverished in any way, then the immune system doesn't develop in the way that it should. And this is thought to underlie a whole series of diseases, including, for example, autoimmune conditions, which is where the immune system targets part of the host cells, a bit like a faction of the British Army turning its attention on Birmingham, for example. It's exactly the same with, you know, for example, type 1 diabetes, where the, you know, the immune system focuses on the beta cell. It causes destruction and death of the beta cell and lack of insulin and the need for insulin replacement. Also, atopies and food allergies and, for example, are all part of that. We think that's, you know, originates from the gut, but also many chronic inflammatory conditions, which encompasses a whole swathe of modern chronic 21st century diseases. In fact, Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, stated that all disease starts in the gut. And it took, you know, over two millennia for the prescience of the great man to become manifest. So I think, coming back to your question, okay, so what are the links between the microbiota and metabolism? Well, again, we could talk all day on this, but there are a handful of mechanisms which are, we think, are particularly relevant. We've got to remember that the gut is an incredibly complex endocrine organ. In fact, the most complex of any organ or any system, I should say, in the body. And we're still in our infancy in really understanding the true complexity of the gut. And a lot of the hormones and neurotransmitters that the gut manufactures are actually similar or in many cases the same as the neurotransmitters in the brain. So you can see automatically that there's a link between the brain and the gut. There's a very complex two-way interactions between the brain and the gut. And one of the ways in which the gut microbiota can influence metabolism and appetite is through the release of hormones from the gut wall. And one example would be something called GLP-1, which is glucagon-like peptide 1, which is released from the distal ileum, which is the small bowel, in response to nutrients. And we know that microbiota can influence that production. And GLP-1 has direct effects on the appetite centers of the brain to suppress appetite. And other incretin hormones like GIP, for example, and glucagon are thought to have metabolic effects as well within the brain. So one way in which the microbiota can influence metabolism and appetite is mediated through hormone release from the gut, but also neuronal transmission as well. So there's a very important nerve called the vagus nerve, okay, which is a two-way nerve. It links the brain with the gut, okay, through neuronal signaling. And we think that the microbiota can influence the a transmission within the vagal nerve, which can then impact on brain functioning. And we've got some fascinating insights from rodents that are so-called germ-free rodents. So they're raised in sterilized environments and they don't have proper functioning gut microbiota. And we know, for example, from those insights that there's a particular factor called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. And we know from germ-free rodents that they lack BDNF. And BDNF is an incredibly important factor for the brain. It's involved in neuronal plasticity and neuronal growth and development. And if you don't have BDNF, then you're susceptible to psychiatric disease, depression, memory problems, dementia, and so on. BDNF is essential for functioning of the brain. And we know, as I said, from rodent studies, if you don't have a proper functioning microbiota, then, you know, BDNF levels are low, and that's obviously bad for the brain. Also, another neurotransmitter called GABA, or gamma aminobutyric acid, which is the main brake on the brain. It basically kind of reassures the brain and it dampens down kind of activity. So it's very important to in terms of avoidance of seizure activity, but also in terms of avoidance of anxiety. And again, we know that the microbiota can impact on that process as well. And in addition to that, there may be direct effects of the microbiota on the brain through, for example, the endotoxins, which we can talk about in a bit, but also the factors that the microbiota actually produce. So the metabolic byproducts of the microbiota. We've got to remember that a lot of our nutrients, our energy extraction from the nutrients that we eat are derived from the microbiota. And we know that, for example, short-chain fatty acids, which are derived from microbiota, can have direct impacts on the brain and metabolic functioning. And also things like secondary bile acids as well. Now, microbiota are essential for converting primary to secondary bile acids, which can then have downstream effects. So that's just a few examples of the ways in which there can be interactions between the microbiota and the brain and metabolic functioning.
Now, just before we go any further, because there's a huge amount of specificity here, and I don't want people to feel that they're out of control, because there's lots of specifics. Let's just roll back a little bit, because you're an endocrinologist, and endocrinology is the study of, as I understand it, hormones and messaging systems. And in case any of our listeners are thinking that hormones are really sort of defining tools of sexuality and reproduction, they are ways of messaging, aren't they? They are. Chemical messaging system, it's important not to get distracted by the word hormone. It's sort of a tool for sending a message. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think if you kind of ask the lay person off the street, what do you think about hormones? They might think about, you know, premenstrual syndrome or yeah. that kind of thing, you know, feeling hormonal or whatever. But actually hormones, like you say, it's essentially a chemical messenger, okay, which travels usually in the blood. It's released from a cell and then it travels at a distance and it has some effects, you know, in a cell elsewhere. There are examples of hormones which can act locally, so-called paracrine effects or even autocrine effects, where the chemical acts on the same cell that's released the hormone. But our traditional understanding of hormones, as I said, it often travel in the blood and act at a distance. And, you know, hormone come up all over physiology. I mean, literally every system, every physiological process pretty much is influenced by hormonal signaling. And I think it's true to say that, as I said, I mean, in the case of the gut, we are in our infancy in our understanding of the hormonal complexities of the gut. We still don't fully understand its true complexity. And I think it would, you know, that's going to be a challenge for the coming years and decades to really understand that. But, you know, some of our more recent treatments for type 2 diabetes, for example, based on GLP-1 or glucagon-like peptide 1. I mean, that is an example of an incretin hormone. So it's a hormone that's released from the gut in response to nutrients, which then has downstream effects on pancreatic functioning in the postprandial phase, so after a meal, to enhance insulin release and suppress glucagon and to suppress appetite. So in essentially, GLP-1 is maintaining glucose control in the few hours after a meal, and it's suppressing appetite, so it's stopping us from eating and eating. So, of course, when you're eating a meal, you'll notice that your appetite goes down, and that's an important response. It's a kind of feedback response, and that's largely mediated through these kind of incretin hormones.
Yeah, and this ties together one of the concepts about the gut microbiome that I think people have found a bit difficult, which is people say that there's a gut-brain axis, that there's a communication between the gut and the brain, and I think until it's explained in the way you have, you kind of think, well, what is this magical thing that's going on? But if it's basic biochemistry and it's a signaling system whereby a chemical is sent from one place to another, has an effect, that makes it a little bit more easy to understand, I guess.
I think you're right, and I think, to be honest, this whole kind of difficulty has been, I think, in some ways worsened by the medical profession, because we do work in silos. We're specialists. So I'm an endocrinologist. My colleagues are gastroenterologists. Other colleagues are neurologists and psychiatrists. And ne'er the twain shall meet. Right? I mean, they look at their after their own conditions, and you know, perhaps a neurologist might not think too much about the GI system, and vice versa. And at the end of the day, of course, they're entirely separate anatomically. I mean, there's obviously no direct links anatomically between the gut and the brain. Other than perhaps, you know, the neuronal links, the kind of autonomic links, but there's no kind of elementary tract which links the gut to the brain. But nonetheless, you know, we know, as I said, through complex endocrine interactions, neuronal signaling, byproducts of metabolism from the microbiota themselves, and also the microbiota in terms of endotoxins, they can all impact on brain functioning and metabolism. And importantly, this is a two-way interaction. So it's not just the case that the microbiota are influencing brain function. It actually works the other way as well. So we know that if you're stressed, for example, that can have impact on the microbiota, and it can lead to a reduction in the diversity of the microbiota, and a move towards dysbiosis compared with eubiosis. And I think it's probably worth just explaining what those terms mean. And I think they're quite blunt terms. I mean, eubiosis implies a state of health and well-being within the gut microbiota, and generally refers to a very diverse microbiota. Okay, compared with dysbiosis on the other end of the spectrum, where you have a very restricted microbiota, which associates with leakiness of the gut wall and inflammatory cascades and all of the kind of disease processes that I mentioned before. But the reality is that there's a spectrum between the two. You know, you're somewhere on that spectrum of eubiosis and dysbiosis. But I think, as I said, and mental functioning can influence where you are on that spectrum directly. And you know, we don't fully understand the mechanisms, but it's likely to be at least partly related to neuronal transmission, for example, vagal nerve signals, for example, I think could well be implicated, but likely many other factors as well.
Okay, so let's explore the basics of this. Well, basics is pretty complex for me. So what are bacterial endotoxins, and do they have a specific function within the gut? Because as you say, bacteria, toxin, these words seem negative, but are there some that are good and some that are bad for us, or are they just are?
So endotoxin, another name for it is lipopolysaccharide, and essentially these refer to the cell walls of certain bacteria, so-called gram-negative bacteria. Okay, lipopolysaccharide or endotoxin, they basically mean the same thing, and it simply refers to a component of the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria which reside in the gut. Okay, so when you have a so-called leaky gut and you have microbiota transitioning from the gut into the bloodstream across the gut wall, then they can form what's called endotoxin, and the endotoxins then travel in the blood. If they're at a high level, it's got a name, it's called endotoxemia. Okay, and we know from studies previously published that endotoxins can actually stimulate a inflammatory reaction, particularly in, for example, the adipose tissue or the fat tissue. Now, this is at a very low grade. It's not like, where you got an infection in your hand or something, you get a big inflammatory. This is a kind of low grade inflammation, okay, which we can detect incidentally through blood tests. We can use something called highly sensitive CRP, which tells us if there's a kind of low grade inflammation process going on. But we know that's the case, and we think that the endotoxin, as I said, can stimulate this low grade inflammatory process, but also influence functioning of the cells. So-called mitochondrial function. Mitochondria are the main kind of powerhouse of the cell, and we know that endotoxins can influence mitochondrial function, and also signaling within the insulin pathway, which is a very important factor in the development of type 2 diabetes. So we think that this kind of endotoxinemia and the kind of resultant chronic inflammatory response can be a forerunner to conditions like type 2 diabetes, but also many other, modern day 21st century conditions, which incidentally are often underlined by a kind of chronic inflammatory milieu.
Now, you mentioned a phrase which sounds odd and scary. What is leaky gut?
So leaky gut, yeah, it's a bit of a so it's so we know that the intactness of the gut wall is important, okay? And why is it important? Well, of course, I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, the gut microbiota are our friends, okay? They help our immune system to work, but they do that best when they're confined to the gut, right? Okay, so there's the interaction between the gut microbiota, where they should be inside the gut, and the blood supply around the gut, the kind of immune system around the gut. The problem is if the gut wall becomes less intact, and it allows some of those microbiota to escape across the gut wall or transition into the blood, then that can be problematic, and that can lead to, as I said, inflammatory responses and other, a multitude of, disease processes and impaired cell functioning, for example. So we know that there's also a mucus layer as well, which is very important to protect the gut wall. So it's not just the intactness of the wall itself, it's the mucus layer. And we know that there are certain factors which can impair that the mucus layer and the intactness of the gut wall. For example, as one thing I mentioned earlier, chronic stress, for example. Alcohol excess can have a negative impact, for example. Fatty foods can impair the intactness of the gut wall. And we think it's partly at least due to the impact of those lifestyle factors we have on the microbiota themselves. And we know that certain species of microbiota are favorable for promoting mucus growth and intactness of the gut wall, and others can do the opposite. So I think, the intactness of the gut wall is incredibly important. It's also important, incidentally, for liver disease as well. We talked about the gut-brain axis, but there's also a gut-liver axis. Remember, once anything that's absorbed through the gut wall goes directly to the liver. That's the first port of call via the portal vein. So any, endotoxins, for example, that leak across the gut wall goes directly to the liver. And that can lead to fatty liver, for example. It can lead to an inflammatory change within the liver. And in fact, fatty liver is now the commonest cause of liver disease globally, believe it or not. It's actually surpassed alcohol as the commonest cause of cirrhosis. Okay, so not everyone with fatty liver develops cirrhosis, only about 1%, in fact. But, you know, with the increasing rates of fatty liver, and now it's an incredibly common condition globally, you know, over the years and decades to come, we will inevitably see increase in liver disease. So I think that the intactness of the gut wall is incredibly important. And I think a lot of our kind of healthy lifestyle advice ultimately, you know, in some way often improves the intactness of the gut wall. It may do many other things as well, but a lot of healthy lifestyle advice like diet, stress reduction, sleep and exercise and so on, in some way impact on the gut wall intactness. So leaky gut is just a term, as I said, as it says on the tin, it's just implying a gut wall that's not fully intact, which allows microbiota to leak across. Yeah.
And so are there external factors that contribute to the presence of endotoxins? Are they just always there, but the problem is when the gut wall isn't intact? And how can things like diet change this?
Yeah, so I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, if you have endotoxin at a very, very low level, it probably won't cause a major problem. I think it is very much a you know, question of degree. And as I said earlier, endotoxemia is where you have, you know, the levels increase beyond a certain threshold. You know, if it's below that threshold, then probably the immune system can deal with it. And I think, you know, it would probably be... you know, I don't think you could envision an entirely intact gut wall that doesn't let any endotoxins cross at all. So it is a question of degree, I think. But I think in addition to that, there's also clearly a multitude of other factors which come into play as well. And, you know, one of which we mentioned already, right? The immune system, or the functioning of the immune system. Okay, so you know, if your immune system is impaired in some way, or if it isn't fully developed, then maybe you're going to be more susceptible to you know, the presence of endotoxins, for example. We know that there's a link, for example, between stress and immune functioning. It's one of the reasons why you're more likely to get colds and infections if you're stressed, because of the direct link there between the two. Of course, genetics will play a role as well. Age, of course, sex. I mean, there's a whole range of factors which can impact on your susceptibility to, you know, to endotoxin effects. Okay, but in terms of the, you know, in terms of what we can do for ourselves, we know that, as I mentioned earlier, healthy lifestyle is incredibly important in this regard. As I mentioned, you know, stress itself can impact directly on the microbiota. It can diminish the diversity of the microbiota, which can then lead to you know, dysbiotic processes. Now, in terms of dietary effects, well, the best advice is to have a healthy and varied diet and to focus on a plant-based diet, because we know that fiber is probably the most relevant macronutrient when it comes to nurturing our gut microbiota. We know that the microbiota thrive on fiber, and it's particularly the fiber that doesn't get digested properly. It ends up in the large bowel. This is a bit like adding fertilizer to your garden, right? If you want your plants to grow well, give them fertilizer. And it's exactly the same principle with our gut microbiota. Okay, unfortunately, in the Western world, most of us are fiber impoverished. Studies have suggested that perhaps we have about two-thirds of the fiber intake that we should have, and that's both European and North American studies. So we should probably all be increasing our fiber intake by about 50% in the Western world. Okay. Of course, a lot of that's down to ingestion of highly processed foods, which are typically fiber impoverished. So we should be cooking from raw ingredients. And as I said, having, you know, plant-based diet, that's not to say avoid meat completely, but as it's just that most of us do need more vegetables and fruit than we're actually getting, and nuts, for example. As I mentioned, reduction in stress, and also sleep as well. Sleep is incredibly important. And what's some of the fascinating data that are coming through recently is on something called chronobiology. And this is relates to how all of our cells and physiology functions according to the time of day. And this is a fascinating area of physiology. But what's incredibly interesting is that we now know that the gut microbiota themselves also have this kind of chronobiological process as well. And that's entrained to our own kind of circadian rhythm. So in other words, when we go to sleep, our microbiota go to sleep as well. Okay, so this is an incredible thought, isn't it? So if you're kind of disrupting your sleep-wake cycle and you have, you know, erratic sleep times, for example, then it confuses the gut microbiota. Mm. And they get confused and they behave in ways that aren't helpful to us. And they can then lead to, you know, disease processes. So this is, you know, this is insights which have come very recently. So, you know, I think the kind of take home message really from this interview is that, you know, we should be nurturing our gut microbiota. You know, they are our friends. And if we look after them, they will look after us. Okay. Another, you know, and this is particularly apt, obviously, in the kind of post-COVID era, but we know that, you know, face-to-face interaction as well is important, right? And we know that our, you know, we've evolved to be social animals, to interact with other humans on a physical level, because by sharing our microbiota, that diversifies our microbiota, yes, and facilitates, yeah, health. But if we're kind of isolated, you know, on our own with no interaction with any of the humans, just over the computers and so on, that's actually not good. It's not good for us. We're, you know, our health will suffer ultimately as a result of that. So, you know, optimizing our one-to-one interaction with other humans is important as well.
Yeah. Now let's just go back to the research that I mentioned in the introduction. So this is uncovering another potential link between gut microbiome and metabolism. Now I believe you weren't part of this study, but they are. It is at the same university as yours. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Correct.
Can you expand on it a little bit and tell us a little bit more about what they found?
Okay, so this particular study that you're referring to was looking at endotoxemia that we kind of mentioned already, but specifically in relation to functioning of adipose tissue or fat cells. Okay, so that's really essentially what they were looking at. And what they found essentially was that the functioning of these fat cells is influenced in a negative way by the presence of endotoxin. And so, for example, the mitochondrial functioning, the way in which the efficiency with which the mitochondria kind of processed energy, if you like, and facilitated kind of oxidation and that kind of thing, was impaired in the presence of endotoxemia. In addition to that, they also looked at something called brown versus white fat, and so this is kind of more relevant really for rodents, but I guess it's important to understand what we mean by that. So what we most of us think about fat is white fat. Okay. So this is the fat that we have under our skin, around our abdomens. And the main function is essentially to store energy, right? That's its main function. Okay. But we know that there's also another type of fat called brown fat, which is, you know, most human adults have very little, perhaps 50 grams or thereabouts. In fact, many adults may not have any brown fat at all. But this does the opposite. It essentially burns fat, okay, and sugar, and releases heat in the process, okay? So rather than taking energy and storing it, it takes the energy and burns it and then releases heat. And we think that it's a bit like a central heating system, okay, for the body. And obviously, you know, that's particularly relevant if you're a mouse, because you've got a very large surface area to volume ratio. So you're going to lose a lot more heat. You're more susceptible to hypothermia. So, of course, mice and rats have huge amounts of brown fat because they need to have bigger boilers to generate more heat to keep themselves alive. Whereas, you know, larger mammals like us and elephants, for example, I don't think have any brown fat because they don't need it, right? So if you've got a small surface area to volume ratio, there's not as much a need. Interestingly, when we're first born, so neonates have a big pad of brown fat between the shoulder blades. And of course, when you're first born, your surface area to volume ratio is relatively large. So you're susceptible. You're not born with any clothes on. You might be born in a cave. So obviously you're vulnerable to hypothermia. So from an evolutionary perspective, you can understand exactly why you would be born with brown fat reserves. And that's exactly what we see in humans. But we think that kind of brown fat pad disappears, you know, over the, you know, in infancy. But we know that white fat can develop features of brown fat. It's so-called browning effect. And so the phenotype of the, if you like, of the fat cells themselves, again, a bit like U biases versus dys biases. There's a spectrum, and so you can have a white fat cell in the lab, and you can influence it to develop features of brown fat. So in other words, it will burn off some energy and release some heat. Okay, and so what they showed also was that the endotoxin can impair that process. Okay, so in other words, that kind of potential for browning effect was impaired by the presence of endotoxin. And we know that the levels of endotoxin are related to obesity. And we know that, for example, after bariatric surgery, when you have an operation to help with the weight and you lose weight, then endotoxin levels can go down after that procedure. And so we think that, at least some of the beneficial effects on metabolism following weight loss, for example, may be mediated through reductions in endotoxin levels. So that's essentially what the study showed.
Gotcha. And what can we do with that information? Is there anything actionable, or is it just part of the journey along the way to understanding both the metabolism and the microbiota?
Well, I think the main thing really is that it improves our understanding and insights into the complex interactions between diet, weight, obesity, and metabolic functioning, and certainly the processes that implicate the functioning of the adipose tissue itself. I think that's really the main insight. Now, there may, of course, be therapeutic implications for this if we can in some way, develop a therapy that can reduce endotoxin levels in the blood in those patients with endotoxemia. Then of course that could be a potential future therapeutic strategy to as a way to improve the metabolic functioning of adipose tissue and overall metabolic health. For example, that could be one strategy. Or I guess we could develop therapies and directly impact on the intactness of the gut wall itself. But I suspect that regardless of whatever therapies we come up with in the future, the kind of principles of healthy lifestyle will remain, just like it does for obesity. We have a few therapies for obesity currently which can inhibit appetite, many more in development, but ultimately, any therapy to lose weight will ultimately depend upon behavior change. And healthy lifestyle is, when it comes down to it, is really the key. So whatever therapy we come up with, as I said, I don't think it's going to replace, healthy principles of healthy lifestyle.
Do you sort of personally get frustrated about the fact that this just seems to me another weapon in the armory against crap diet and taking some exercise, and yet it's so difficult to achieve significant behavioural change?
Yeah, I think this is a hugely complex area, and I think clearly there's this huge misunderstanding about obesity, okay, and its causes and its pathogenesis. There's also a stigma to obesity within our society, and I think a lot of that stigma stems from deep-rooted misunderstanding. There's a kind of perception that you gain weight and become obese because of human vices, because you're greedy, because you're lazy, because you can't be bothered to do exercise and that kind of thing. And those, it's a very cruel society that we live in, and those kind of perceptions are entirely false. Okay, often there can be complex psychological and emotional reasons why people gain weight. And in my experience, often it can stem from childhood experiences. Often food can be used as a kind of coping strategy for some psychological or emotional trauma that has been experienced in the past, and that can be very difficult to overcome. Okay. But in many cases, it's simply a complex interaction between our genetics and our environment. And there's always been a spectrum of BMI within the population, just like height. It's a complex biological trait which is influenced by multiple gene variants. And of course, whenever that occurs in biology, there's always a bell-shaped or normal distribution. That's always been the case. What's differed over the last 100 or so, 50 years particularly, is that whole Gaussian distribution has shifted to the right. So everyone's weight has gone up. Now, of course, our genetics hasn't changed in that time, but what has changed radically is our environment, our kind of obesogenic environment, and particularly the kind of ready availability of highly processed, highly calorific, and importantly, high carbohydrate laden processed foods. And I think that particularly occurred in the 1980s. And one of the kind of reasons for that was actually at the time, and still up until very recently, incidentally, there was a whole kind of notion that we should be having a low fat diet. And when processed foods are made with low fat, they become quite unpalatable. And so the response by the food companies was to add in extra sugar to make them palatable. And that, I think, was part of the kind of, in the 1980s, particularly where there was an explosion in this kind of high carbohydrate foods, and the problem with sugar is that it's converted to fat, okay, in the liver. So if you eat sugar, you'll basically gain weight. But I think one of the problems is that sugar's not called fat. Okay, so if you don't know anything about diet or weight or anything, you might assume that sugar, I eat sugar, it's not going to cause me to go fat. But if I eat fat, well, that's called fat, so it's going to make me fat. So there is this kind of, I think it's very unfortunate that we have the label fat for a macronutrient, which actually, in many cases, incidentally, does not in fact cause weight gain. A lot of fats are actually propitious for health and important for health. Okay, so for the polyunsaturated fats, the fats that you get in a Mediterranean diet, the fats that you get in olive oil are actually really healthy. I think to kind of label fats as a whole and say we should avoid fats is clearly wrong. And I think my colleague, Tim Spector, he's written some fantastic books, The Diet Myth and Spoon Fed, which really dispel some of the dietary myths that we have, that we've all been kind of spoon-fed since we were children. And actually, you read that book and you realize that, pretty much everything we've been told about diet is actually wrong, and we really don't understand a lot about diet. And it's incredibly, I would commend your listeners to look at those books, because I think Tim has done a fantastic job there at kind of really helping to dispel some of those myths.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had him on the podcast a couple of times.
Indeed, actually. Indeed.
So if you could grab the population by the lapels and shake it and shout into their ear, what would be the message? Not that shouting really helps, especially with behavioural change. But what do you just want people to do? What change do you really want people to make?
So one of my roles is to lead on the obesity service in Coventry and at UHW, and we have a fantastic team. I've been doing this now for 13 years, and what I sometimes say to my patients, actually, yes, we're an obesity service, but actually, it might sound strange to say this, but actually, losing weight might not be the most important focus for what you need to do here, right? Okay, healthy lifestyle is the key, right? This is the thing.
And even if you don't stress as well,
absolutely, even if you don't lose weight, that will have huge impact on your overall health, and I think the first step really, and again, this is a kind of traditionally neglected area, is actually sleep sufficiency. Most of us are sleep deprived, okay, and when we're sleep deprived, our appetite becomes enhanced and we tend to eat more food, particularly carbohydrate laden foods. We know that if you're sleep deprived for a couple of days, you might eat 300 or 400 calories extra the next day. That's been shown in scientific studies. Okay, so sleep deprivation is a real problem. Of course, sleep deprivation can cause all manner of pathological processes, not just appetite enhancement. So it's a really bad thing to be sleep deprived. The experts say we should be getting, as adults, at least 7.5 hours sleep per night. Many of us don't get enough. Okay, so the first step, in my view, is to focus on sleep. The problem is if you try and change your diet, or go on any diet, or for that matter, any kind of exercise regime or whatever it is, it's incredibly difficult to do if you don't get enough sleep. So that should be the first principle, I think. Once you've sorted, now, of course, that's easier said than done in many cases. Many people have insomnia. indeed. But there are certain principles of sleep hygiene which can help. Okay, so that's the first thing. Obviously, activity, I think, I would put as number two. And we often talk about exercise, which kind of conjures up the image of going on a treadmill or going down the gym. Not everyone can do that for lots of reasons, but actually the message should be to avoid sedentariness. And sedentariness simply means sitting or lying activities, so anything, even standing up, is avoidance of sedentariness. And the worst thing you can do is to go to work for 8 hours a day, sit at your desk and never get up. Okay. With studies have shown that if you get up every hour or so and just do a few squats in the corner, or even just walk around the office, okay, or down the corridor for 2 or 3 minutes every hour, you will have transformative effects on your metabolic health. We know that in diabetes, for example, sugar control is much improved just by that very simple change. Okay, so you don't have to climb Mount Everest. You don't have to even go down the gym. Just be more active. You know, use your arms and your legs more, right? That's the key. Of course, if you can combine that with exercise, then great. I mean, you know, half an hour of exercise that gets you into a sweat is fantastic, right? So that's a really good thing as well. And then, of course, diet. We've talked about this already, but I think, you know, there's, as I said, over the years and decades, there's been a lot of emphasis on low-fat diets, which I think is unfortunate, because actually that's not really what the key message should be. I think if you had to choose one, you'd probably say, well, optimize your fiber intake, and you get that through primarily through plant-based foods, cooking food from raw ingredients, avoiding the highly processed foods, and particularly the carbohydrate-laden, you know, highly processed foods as well. And as Tim Spector says in his book, avoiding the idea that of this kind of so-called average human, you know, this kind of idea that we all need to adopt a, you know, one size fits all approach to, you know, food intake and so on. We're all different. We're all individuals, and we all likely have different, you know, nutritional requirements. Okay. And so I think, yes, so that's important. And I think, plant-based diet, as I said, but particularly, and I think the principles, as I said, food, diet, activity, sleep, also, as I said, social interaction is good for the physical interaction, is good for the microbiome, and of course stress relief, which of course is easier said than done. But if you apply those principles 1, 2, and 3, then that should enable you to deal better with stress. And, you know, if you're sleep deprived, then of course you're going to be more susceptible to stress. Okay. So this is, I think, a key aspect of that. So I think those are probably the main principles I would kind of advocate.
Sounds pretty clear. Okay. So last question really is, what's next for this area of research, or for the work that you're doing? What are you hoping to discover? What areas really need to be investigated more?
Well, I think we're very much in our infancy in understanding the gut microbiome. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, that the, you know, this, in terms of numbers, the cells of the microbiome probably outnumber our own. So we're all kind of more foreign cells than we are human cells, which is remarkable, isn't it? And even though the microbiome in the gut only weighs about 2 kilograms, and I think we need to transform our notion of the gut microbiome from this kind of seething mass of microbes, which is kind of just a potential, causing potential disease if it gets into the bloodstream, to one which is functions like an organ. Okay, so although it's not an organ in the conventional sense, it does have essential functions for physiology, and I think in that sense we should be considering it as an organ. And I think a lot of the insights that we have on the gut microbiome, it should be stated, stem from rodent, mice and rat-based data, so we need to be cautious in extrapolating those data to humans. You know, rodents engage in something called coprophagia, which is as disgusting as it sounds, you know, humans don't. So this is the, you know, I mean, their behavior traits are different from humans. Okay. So we shouldn't necessarily, say, well, just because this happens in a rat, it happens in a human. We know that you can transform the metabolic status, indeed, even body weight of a rat through transforming its fecal microbiota. Human-based studies haven't yet shown such effects. So there's been some data on changing glucose status, but not on body weight in humans. Currently, the only indication for fecal microbiota transplantation in the NHS is for intractable Clostridium difficile, which can happen in hospitals, for example, where you can get through antibiotic use, you can get this kind of C. diff infection, which can cause horrendous diarrhea and can be very difficult to treat. And we know that actually FMT or fecal microbiota transplant can actually be very effective in that regard. But, you know, the future, you know, I think as I mentioned earlier, we're very much in our infancy in understanding the microbiota and how we can impact on it. But I think certainly fecal microbiota transplantation may well certainly have a role in the future. you know, transforming our microbiota in some way to a more healthy kind of eubiotic status, I think is certainly is likely to occur at some stage. But we clearly need many more human-based data to kind of really corroborate, you know, what we've shown in rodents. And there's still many kind of unknown questions that remain. I think the other key aspect here is that a lot of the studies on the microbiota, if you look at the literature, and incidentally, there's been over 5,000 studies per year in recent years. So it's a huge, hugely topical area, this. But often these studies focus on one particular strain of bacteria, and they say, this strain does this. This is a good bacteria. This is the bad bacteria. You know? And I think in the context of trillions of microbes all interacting with each other and with the host, that's clearly doesn't really make much sense. And I think we're going to have to move towards a kind of more colony based perspective of how the entire...
You almost said the word holistic.
Yeah, indeed. That's right. how this functions as a whole, how the individual microbiota influence each other and influence the host. And that's really the challenge for the future, because that is an incredibly complex area. And I'll leave you with just one thought and this kind of fascinating thought. Okay, so the human genome contains around 22,000 genes, right? In fact, it's less than an earthworm, okay? Believe it or not. So I think an earthworm's got over 30,000 genes. But the microbiota, if you look at the genes within our microbiota, that has about 2.5 million genes, which is over two orders of magnitude greater genetic kind of reserve, if you like, than what we have in our human cells. Okay. So 100-fold greater, you know, genes that occur within our microbiome to what we have in our human cells. So I think, you know, of course, when the Human Genome Project came about, we were all very excited, weren't we, about, you know, how this is going to tell us insights into everything.
We're going to understand everything,
exactly.
Now.
But of course, that's probably about 1%, right? If you look at the microbiota, you know, there's a whole load of potential there in terms of understanding the genomes of the microbiota and how that impacts on our physiology.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, look, that was dense, specific. It was complex. There was this discussion of fecal transplants and leaky gut, but that was absolutely fascinating. So, Thomas Barber, thank you so much for joining me.
Okay, thank you very much.